What I'm going to talk about partly reflects a project I've just completed on economic patriotism, which has just been published as a special issue of the Journal of European Public Policy. And one of the things that project does is to look at the underlying social tensions within contemporary capitalisms, and I think they're particularly useful to think about the Eurozone crisis in terms of those underlying social tensions. One of the authors of one of the papers in that project is a previous participant in the Warwick Right debate, Colin Crouch, and he develops a very useful frame of reference, I think, for understanding some of these tensions. He talks about the paradox of neoliberal democracy, which reveals some profound, if not necessarily self-evident, contradictions between international market integration on the one hand and spatially limited political mandates on the other. So in a world characterized by overlapping networks of economic governance, politicians face this paradox of neoliberal democracy where they have to meet the interests of their citizenry, but given the complex international economic interdependence, they don't have complete jurisdiction over their economic spaces. So they're trying to achieve economic governance over a national economy over which they no longer have exclusive control. Now this, in Colin Crouch's version, is a kind of permanent feature of contemporary capitalism. It's kind of endemic within interdependent markets. But I think it's particularly interesting to think about the Eurozone crisis in the light of this paradox. So the paradox becomes more pronounced as levels of market integration increase and as the international jurisprudence that surrounds market integration is augmented. And particularly in relation to Europe, the paradox has deepened as European integration has deepened. So as the process of European integration advances, the scale of the tensions and contradictions created is enhanced. Now, we've only got to look at the history of the Eurozone pre-crisis to reveal some of those tensions. So if you look at the macroeconomic policy architecture of the euro up until 2008, those tensions reared their ugly heads and were reflected in and managed by attempts by the French government in particular to actually soften the old Stability and Growth Pact around about 2005. So the fairly strict-ish rules on budget discipline and low debt levels generated contradictions and crises and tensions that were managed through revising the old rules back in the day. And we've only got to look at the current fiscal pact to see that we've ramped the rules back up to a very rigid and strict level. But if you look at what Holland and Spain are already saying about their inability to meet the budget deficit requirements in the next couple of years, I think we can see another wave of the kind of tensions and contradictions that we saw in the mid-2000s probably rearing its ugly head in the next couple of years. So that's just one way in which the current Eurozone crisis reveals this paradox of neoliberal democracy and how the tensions are raised. But I think if you look at the Greek example, we see how those tensions are raised to really stratospheric levels. So the Greek economy and Greek political economy gives a particularly egregious example, I think, of this paradox of neoliberal democracy. So that the governments in the run-up to agreeing the bailout were forced to pre-commit, the governments and parties in Greece were forced to pre-commit before the elections that are coming up in a few months, that they would not go to the country promising policies that would in any way conflict with the macroeconomic policy stance they've agreed to and on the basis of which they received the recent funds. So they're forced, each Greek government for however many years to come is forced to commit to the austerity measures despite unemployment at around about 20%, despite no growth, despite increasing hardship, despite increasing poverty. So that, I think, is quite revealing of the kind of paradox of neoliberal democracy and the constraints that governments face. The other side of the economic patriotism story is that governments can shift their allegiance, if you like, from the national level potentially to other levels, including the European regional level. And in that regard, what's there for the Greeks to hope for, if you like, in the interest of patriotism towards the Eurozone, is to creep growthlessly and very painfully towards debt levels at around about 120.5% of GDP by 2020. Well, that doesn't seem like very much to hope for me. So I think this current crisis, the crisis of the euro, is revealing of some really quite profound social tensions that are revealed not just in Greece, but actually more widely across the Eurozone. Just before we had the recent agreement in the Euro summit, there was a report about unemployment across the Eurozone at historically high levels. So that includes Portugal, Spain and Italy, as well as Greece. And as Birgitta pointed out, some of those economies are in very different shape to Greece, not nearly the kind of basket case scenarios that Greece enjoys. Nevertheless, unemployment at a very high level. So how do we understand these social tensions and the Eurozone crisis in the light of these social tensions? Well, I think one of the kind of go-to scholars for IPE in relation to social tensions is Karl Polanyi, who was mentioned briefly earlier. And I think his analysis is really quite pertinent and quite useful to thinking about what faces Europe's political economies in the contemporary crisis and in the years ahead. So he talks about the dangers of what he termed disembedded market relations and the problems raised by self-regulated markets, as he talked about them, transcending national borders, and how this would create instabilities and vulnerabilities for the societies of post-war, well, of 19th century Britain, he was talking about, but we can transpose that to contemporary Europe, I think. So there's this dialectic in Polanyi's thinking about capitalism between economic liberalism on the one hand and the forces of, or the needs for social protection of some form or another on the other hand. And his analysis of the 19th century was how they, as he termed it, the violent imposition of the market organisation of society generated all kinds of instabilities and risked annihilating the human and natural substance of society, as he put it. So there's a problem if market relations are not in some way embedded in society, as he put it, that they would generate acute social dislocation. And this was one of what Polanyi termed the congenital weaknesses of market society, these pernicious effects of a market-controlled economy. And Birgitta talked about some of these pernicious effects. It's things like deflation, unemployment, poverty being kind of locked in to the Eurozone in much the same way as Polanyi identified these processes being locked into the 19th century and the gold standard. So there's this notion that societal interests cannot really be articulated and they cannot address or resolve social problems because of inexorable and intractable external economic pressures. And that's pretty much where a country like Greece is situated in relation to the contemporary Eurozone crisis, with unemployment around about 20%, little or no imminent prospect of improvement. And that is obviously going to have deeply destabilising impacts on Greek society, but more widely across Europe, because as I say, it's not just a Greek phenomenon. Low employment, high structural unemployment, and its ongoing prospect throughout the Eurozone is a feature for many of Europe's economies right now. So the settlement that's been reached in recent weeks as the means to respond to the crisis and resolve the crisis, I think, runs the risk of generating more social instability, more unrest, and undermining the credibility of the Eurozone, which obviously the whole edifice is designed to create. So what I want to explore in the next section of my talk is well, why is that so? Why are those tensions so profound? They seem so self-evident, and yet they are not being addressed. Well, the talk title is Whose Crisis? And I think here it makes sense to refer back to some of the things that Birgitta said about the banks and their lot within in the context of the crisis. And a kind of dominant neoliberal narrative, you might call it. And I think I do think I'm in neoliberal and not ordo-liberal. Neoliberal narrative about moral hazard in the wake of the crisis. So we've talked a lot about moral hazard, and it has been much talked about. But the reprovals and the admonitions are all directed towards fiscally profligate national governments, and they haven't been directed towards the investment banking industry or the great finance houses of Europe. And why is that? I think it clearly has a lot to do with what we might call the structural power of large-scale finance. And if we look at state market relations and interactions since the 2008 phase of the crisis, they've demonstrated this structural power to a very significant degree. Many of Europe's great finance, globalised finance houses have very close links with governments. The French case, which I'm very familiar with, is a very good case in point. And it's hard to look past this structural power of large-scale finance, I think, for explanations of the way things like debt restructuring and debt haircuts and so on have been addressed. They've all been addressed in ways to effectively preserve the interests of European banks. Further evidence of this, if we think of the old Watergate slogan, "If you follow the money." Where has the European Central Bank been directing its 1 trillion euros in two tranches of soft loans? It's been to prop up Europe's biggest banks. Now, if we look at the first phase of the Eurozone, the grand global financial crisis, 2008 and 9, and compare it with the contemporary phase, of course, there was a great deal of securing the balance sheets of the big banks and the socialisation of risk that Brigitte talked about by national governments. But that happened alongside a whole series of other measures and interventions and activities, kind of Keynesian style, and not neo-Keynesian of the kind Magna was talking about, but old-school Keynesian style, demand boost and stimulus packages and all the rest of it, to help prop up other economic actors and other sections of the populace, if you like. If we look at the Eurozone crisis response in the contemporary period, we don't really have any of those other measures being contemplated or undertaken. So in the current phase, the soft loans to prop up the European banks are the only means to avert a kind of credit crunch and ensure enough demand in the economy. That's not to say that other authoritative voices within the international political economy are not suggesting some of the alternative measures, some of the perhaps Keynesian-style fiscal policies, the social transfers towards vulnerable groups, and how these can have positive multiplier effects on economic activity and growth overall. Those ideas are out there, and they're out there in some quite surprising locations. The International Monetary Fund continually produces reports and offers policy commentary and policy advice suggesting these kinds of macroeconomic policies, fiscal policies, broadly speaking Keynesian fiscal policies, that should be part of the policy arsenal to address their countries. Not for all economies, but for those countries with a fiscal space where they would have the possibility to pursue these policies. So countries like Germany, the surplus countries, again, coming back to what Brigitte said, would be in a position to deploy some of these kind of fiscal policy measures and would be in a position to do something about the kind of low growth, no growth scenario and the kind of eurosclerosis looks like it's set to befall the European economy for the next few years. And if you look at the speeches of people like Christine Lagarde, head of the IMF, she's forever hinting that Germany really ought to get out there and get spending and start behaving differently. And if you like, trying to draw Germany off its ordo-liberal principles that Brigitte outlined so ably. So there's something interesting going in here on here in the current phase of the Eurozone crisis and kind of how the crisis is being narrated and constructed politically, if you like, and what kinds of crisis responses are being deemed appropriate. Something's changing, I think, in the way that fiscal rectitude, as I like to call it, is being constructed in the current crisis phase. So all those earlier ideas about a dose of Keynesianism, a dose of macroeconomic policy activism that were part and parcel of the early crisis response 2008-9, they've pretty much shifted from view in the case of most of the major European economies, and certainly in the case of countries like Germany, who are really holding all the aces, if you like, in terms of how the European Eurozone crisis will be enacted. And that's quite important because there seems to be an important kind of moment that was missed in terms of a changing of the political economic paradigm underpinning macroeconomic policy and how it should be enacted within the Eurozone and more widely in the last few years. So we had the old orthodoxy of 3% budget deficit, 60% or lower national debt to GDP ratios. That was the old settlement of this is what a proper economy looks like. Now, all of that was thrown into flux when deficit levels and debt levels suddenly shot through the roof as countries responded to the first financial crisis, at which point a kind of window opportunity opened to kind of renegotiate, if you like, the balance between neoliberal elements and, here again, I do think I mean neoliberal elements, but perhaps also ordo-liberal elements within the kind of macroeconomic policy settlement and Keynesian elements. And again, here I mean old-school Keynesian elements, not neo-Keynesian elements. You two made it much more complicated for me to say what I wanted to say than I thought it was going to be. Anyway, so there are, in policy practice, there are all kinds of innovative things that went on from 2008 onwards. But if we look at the fiscal pact that's just been agreed, we seem to have closed the window or closed the door on those kinds of more interesting Keynesian-style macroeconomic policy interventions. They've been ruled offside by, here, it is the ordo-liberal principles of the new fiscal pact. So how do we explain that? Well, I think ideational political economy has a great deal to tell us about this. And what ideational political economy, which contributed to by other former right debaters like Vivian Schmidt and Colin Hay and Mark Blythe really tells us is how we need to think about economic rationality as a socially constructed phenomenon. So economic rationality is not so much a variable, is a variable much more than it is an assumption. And this goes back to the ideas of someone like Max Weber as well. So markets and approaches to the operation of the market are social and political constructs. And if we operationalise that insight, we generate distinctive state traditions of political economic interventionism or economic policy making. And obviously, the ideal example in this instance, as Brigitte has talked to us about, is ordo-liberalism as a state tradition in Germany, underpinning and informing the way the German governments are seeking to reinvent, if you like, the Eurozone's economic governments in their own ordo-liberal image. So that involves a particular understanding of what the market is and how the market ought to operate. And it involves an understanding that's heavily rules-based and focused around issues of fiscal discipline. But to some extent, you could see that as somewhat at odds with the kinds of economic ideas and ongoing within other state traditions in Europe. And perhaps I'll mention the British state tradition, and here we are at ordo-liberalism versus neoliberalism. The neoliberal project for how the Eurozone, or how the European economy more widely, should revive itself was exemplified, I think, in some of the things that David Cameron was saying at the European Summit last week, where, as far as he's concerned, there is a problem now of growth for the European economy. Now, that's quite interesting in and of itself, because it seemed to me that the crisis, the financial crisis, was rendered as a crisis of growth in its very early phase, 2008-9, hence all the Keynesianism and all the fiscal stimulus packages at the international coordinated level. It then became very quickly a crisis of debt, and everyone became obsessed with debt in the way that Brigitte has talked us through. There was a slight refrain, a slight shift in the mood music back towards talking about growth again for the first time in a long time in the last couple of bouts of European symmetry. But it's quite interesting what was and wasn't being proposed and promised in terms of how we address the probable lack of growth in Europe's economies in those recent summits. And what David Cameron was saying is all you need is to deepen the single market. You need more financial integration, flexibility of labour markets, the same kind of structural reforms of Europe's economies that British governments have been haranguing the European continental economies with for a generation. And there's no real prospect to assume that that is going to deliver the goods in terms of economic growth anytime dramatically soon, because it might have some beneficial effects, but the timescales really aren't all that helpful. So the competitiveness agenda might work in the long run, but as Keynes said, in the long run, we are all dead. And this isn't just the IMF saying things like that. If you look at what Standard & Poor's said recently when they were downgrading French ratings so their French bonds went from AAA to AA, and the reason they did that was they said, well, the growth prospects for the French economy are so poor that we are beginning to have concerns about the repayment of bonds. So the idea is that fiscal discipline may be a good thing, but it's not the only good thing, and growth is a necessary thing if governments, sovereign governments, want to sustain their creditworthiness. And so the IMF chief economist pointed out how actually financial markets are really rather schizophrenic in their approach to fiscal consolidation. On the one hand, they like fiscal consolidation, they like the kind of fiscal rectitude that it espouses, and they react positively in the short term to those kinds of commitments. But actually, as soon as that fiscal consolidation has an adverse knock-on effect on growth, then they start to react really rather negatively. And so this creates a real tension, a kind of a double bind of the imperative for fiscal consolidation on the one hand, but also the imperative for growth. And the likely impacts on growth of the current pact are really not very promising at all. We're looking at, who knows, 5 to 10 years of low or no economic growth across the Eurozone. And of course, the irony of all that is that what that will do is undermine the credibility with global financial markets that this new fiscal compound is designed to deliver. So there are two real problems here. There are the unresolved underlying social and political tensions within the Eurozone, present more widely, but particularly pronounced in the Eurozone post the recent fiscal pact. And there's also the kind of inconsistency between the demands of fiscal consolidation on the one hand and the need for growth, and that in the absence of growth, what's just been achieved could do more harm than good in terms of credibility with financial markets.
Thank you very much, man.